Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you for being there. I want to thank you for being one of the millions and millions of people who are watching us every single day in five different languages. Really, thank you so much for being there. I want to start with something interesting that has just developed over the last 24 hours, and I think this is extremely important for what's going on right now in the theater that is the war in Iran. And it is the fact that the Saudis are now admitting that they have actually bombed Iran. They have fired at Iran throughout this conflagration, something that nobody really expected. Remember when I went back, remember when I was talking to Arachi? Remember when I was in Iran and I had conversations with all the Iranian foreign ministry officials? And one of the things that I asked them at the time was, how is your relation right now with the Saudis? And they essentially told me we're having conversations constantly with the Saudi foreign ministry, and they understand what a difficult situation we're in, where if the United States hits us, we're going to have to take out some of the installations, including the U.S. installations that are in Saudi Arabia. And I thought pretty much that that's the way things were going to end up standing. But this is different, you know? If you look, and pardon me for a minute, just to give you a little bit of the background on this, right? So Saudi Arabia is a kingdom that basically started as an oil country in basically the 1940s, right? And at that time, they created a relationship with the United States. But that relationship, that oil relationship, was really solidified. It was made a concrete relationship in the 1970s. That's when the petrodollar was established. So everything in terms of oil assets was moved to Washington and through Washington, both in terms of trade and in oil assets. So the United States basically said to the Saudis, look, we are going to give you security. You are going to let us put our bases there, and we're going to feed off of all the oil money that you are going to make there. Of course, the Saudis became very rich in their own right, but that relationship was really important. So much so that the Saudis really trusted the relationship and thought that they would be able to weather just about anything, including this war. So it's not like they really picked sides for the United States. They said they were neutral, but one knew that this was a racket. This was a protection racket that they had established long ago with the United States. And it happened during the petrodollar era in the 1970s. So now this war starts, and what are they going to do? And it seemed like they were playing the field quite nicely, but this new information that they did, in fact, hit Iran is really important, especially knowing what we know now that the Saudis maybe didn't know then about how well the Iranians have done in this war with the United States. Look, Saudis maybe didn't believe it, but they believe it now, and they're going to have to probably pivot. But I've been getting hell from all kinds of people on X for being un-American, for suggesting that the Iranians are actually winning this war, because the Iranians are winning this war. The Iranians are winning this war from a strategic standpoint, not a military standpoint, but from a strategic standpoint. And when it comes to the public relations war globally, hell yes, Iran is winning that as well. And those two things are probably the most important right now, the geopolitical strategic situation and the way the world is seeing this. It's a real boom for Iran right now. And by the way, although I'm getting a lot of hell for saying this, because people are saying it's un-American to tell the truth, which, by the way, it is, I'm not the only one saying it. You know who else is saying it? There's a guy who's like the top neocon in the entire United States. This guy is the king of the neocons. This guy was the guy who basically drew up the invasion plans for Iraq. I'm not kidding. His name is Robert Kagan. He is a neocon to the hilt. Here's what he's saying.
The conflict has revealed an America that is unreliable and incapable of finishing what it started. That is going to set off a chain reaction around the world as friends and foes adjust to America's failure. Defeat for the United States, therefore, is not only possible, but likely.
I got to just tell you a little bit about this guy, because he's a fascinating person. First of all, he's one of the founders of the Project for the New American Century. The Project for a New American Century is a bunch of these really bad people who are all very wealthy and have connections to all the big military industrial companies. And they all got together and they planned the lie that became the invasion of Iraq. These are the guys who did it. And this is one of the founders of this thing, right? This guy right here. He was for the Syria intervention. He's for the Libya intervention. He was for the war in Afghanistan. He was for the war in Iraq. And he was 100% for the war in Iran. Now he's saying, well, we're not winning. It's not like he's not for the war. He just wants Trump to go in there harder, invade harder, maybe even use nukes if he has to. That's how crazy this guy is. Oh, by the way, this guy's married to Victoria Nuland. Do you know who Victoria Nuland is? Victoria Nuland worked at the State Department. Super crazy hawk. She's the woman who was caught on tape secretly fomenting a coup in Ukraine because she hates Russia and wanted to start a war with Russia using Ukraine as a proxy. Gee, she pulled it off. She's the one who did this. She's married to Robert Kagan. Just so you know, a little background on what's going on this day with both Iran and with what's happening right now with Saudi Arabia. Joining me now to talk about this is the perfect guest to have this conversation, given the geopolitics of our world right now. Robert Pape is one of the most sought-after guests. He teaches political science at the University of Chicago. Go Chicago. Robert Pape is good enough to join us right now to talk about it. So many things that are happening. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. I am so happy and honored to have you here with us.
Thank you very much, Rick. It really is a delight to speak to you, to speak to your audience. It's such a critical audience. And I think you gave the perfect run-up to this. I've known Bob Kagan for decades. I've debated him, say, on the Afghanistan surge, things like that. So I'm very well aware of Bob's what's happening here. And the bottom line is what you're seeing is he's catching up to the escalation traps upstairs. So if your listeners would just go to the Escalation Trap Substack, they could compare the 11 weeks ago, what I was saying was going to happen, to what Kagan says is now, and you would see it's almost directly the same. And so Bob's caught up. Now, he would probably want to go a different way than maybe I would want to go, but the bottom line is this is really important to know where we are.
Yeah, let's not fool ourselves. Robert Kagan is not suddenly a dove who's saying, let's get out of here. We need to leave Iran alone. Oh, my God, why in the world did we ever go in there in the first place? No, it is illustrative that he is admitting that Iran is winning this war. He's basically saying yes. Iran is winning this war. He obviously wants Trump to go in there and blow him up. But he's recognizing that maybe if you agree with what I said, in terms of the Strait of Hormuz, In terms of the geopolitics of the moment, Iran has not only won the war, I don't see how they can shake this off. I don't see how the United States can suddenly turn this around. Do you?
No. What's going to happen here, absent some massive escalation, is Iran's going to become, over the next year, 18 months, the fourth center of world power. Mm. It will be the United States, there will be China, there will be Russia, and now Iran, and Iran will become the emerging hegemon, regional hegemon in the Persian Gulf. This is what Kagan is so worried about, because, of course, that means Israel is going to be diminished rather dramatically. But also, it means Iran, if I'm right, in which so far it's been, yeah. Iran is going to want not just to have control of the Straits today, but keep control and keep a $100 barrel of oil going on for probably years because they make out like a bandit. They weaken their opponents. They're also going to want to develop nuclear weapons in the next, say, 18 months or so. And they have all the wherewithal. They have the capability. It's always been with Iran the will. Now, the problem here is it's a trap. See, Iran's not going to take the sucker deal that, oh, sure, we all been bombing the daylights out of you. All you got to do is go back to Feb 27 and we'll never do that again. Rick, do you believe that for a second?
No,
I don't believe
no.
that for a second. No. And the problem here is we've shown them over and over here, you can't trust us to hold off. Well, now you're pushing them in that direction, which I too am not happy about. But the bottom line is there's only one alternative. There's no sucker deal. China's not bailing us out. It means we're going to have to eat casualties. And that's a big order here. And that's where the real hesitation's got to come from. And so Kagan, glad he's understanding where reality is. But we need to think about more clearly, how do we prevent a forever war? This is really now over the next weeks and months, not just a day. We need to think hard as a country. Are we really going to fight another forever war here? That's what Kagan is up.
He is my president and he is your president, but I think he's a lunatic, Mr. Trump. And some of the things that he's been saying lately, and by the way, you just said something really interesting about this whole nuke thing. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm a country out there, country X, whatever, and I'm watching this, what I'm learning is the only way I can be safe from either the United States or some other hegemony out there is to acquire nuclear weapons. We've given Iran every reason to do that, right? I mean,
and not just Iran. You're giving Poland every reason to do that. You're giving South Korea every reason to do that. You're giving Saudi Arabia. And Rick, I saw this coming. I now teach a graduate class at the University of Chicago called Preventive War. This is now my second year teaching it because I was worried we were going down this road. And it's not just President Trump. We're moving to a much more dangerous world here, and the rules have changed. It used to be if you invaded a country, everybody got mad at you. Well, now President Trump's in doing it. So this is not, and by the way, I'm not coming at this politically here. I've been an advisor to Ron Paul. I've been an advisor to Barack Obama. I've advised every White House from 2001 to 2024. That includes two Republican, two Democrat, includes the first Trump White House. It's not about politics. This is about the reality that we're moving here and we're teaching the world.
Yes.
You got to get a nuke.
Gene, go to Trump soundbite one if you have it. Let's watch this. Here's the president.
It was just unacceptable. You know, a lot of people said, well, does he have a plan? Yeah, of course I do. I have the best plan ever. I mean, it's a very simple plan. I don't know why you don't say it like it is. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon.
For the time being, the ceasefire remains in place.
You know, it's unbelievably weak, I would say. I would call it the weakest right now after reading the piece of garbage they sent us. I didn't even finish reading it. They said, I'm not going to waste my time reading it. I would say it's one of the weakest right now. It's our life support.
That's the language not of a fair negotiator. That's the language of a bully. And it seems to me that he's been able to bully effectively. For example, European countries just bow down to him. Like, yes, sir, whatever you want, right? He's been able to bully the European countries. He was able to bully Venezuela. I don't think he can bully China. I don't think he can bully Russia. And I don't think he can bully Iran from what I'm seeing. Am I wrong?
Iran was always the most powerful rival that America went up against since World War II.
Yeah.
I don't mean since Vietnam. So if you would just compare the numbers here, and we probably don't have fully the time to do it, North Vietnam had 18 million people. Iran's 92 million people. If you look at the oil, if you look at that Iran had before the war, you look at the possibility of taking Hormuz, North Vietnam never had anything like those assets and so forth. So this was always a much, much bigger mountain. It's like saying, okay, I have conquered molehills before, you know, I've gotten over mountains that are like 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet. Now I'm going for Mount Everest, okay? This is a different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
And this was always true, Rick. And I'm sorry to say that President Trump here has been treating this like a real estate deal. So you're right. He's been bullying. He may have been bullying people his whole life and making, because those deals as a real estate deal here, you can see, oh, people will just cut the meal. He'll get a better art of the deal. Great power politics isn't like that because you can't cut the deal. Either Iran has nukes or it does not. There's no middle ground. Either Iran controls Hormuz or it does not. And notice even President Trump said, let's split the tolls as if somehow it was a real estate deal. I think he's got the wrong, it's a wrong framing. People say he doesn't have a strategy. I think it's more he has a bad or wrong strategy.
Well said.
And he keeps going back to the same idea, which is okay, this has been a strategic defeat. Let's punish more. Well, in international politics, and it may come as a lot of the listeners' surprise, I've studied this for 30 years, that idea of just punish them, a state, an actor, a nation state more, tends to bring them together, doesn't pull them apart. This isn't like bullies on the schoolyard, the way we grew up in school. It's a different animal that we're up against when we're up against states. And that's what I think is new here for President Trump. I think that he's adopted a bad plan, a bad framework for how to do this. And there's a key mistake he's making, which is if I punish them enough, they're going to break. And that has been a mistake that's led to almost all of America's failures, including Vietnam. That's our key failure mistake. And it's a mistake by smart people, Rick. I think it's not really quite right to say, well, he's just an idiot or so forth. Bill Clinton made these mistakes in Kosovo. Democrats have made the mistakes. This is not really a unique to a Republican or even Trump. It's just that what he did is he picked on the most dangerous adversary we've taken on since World War II. Mm-hmm. Think about that. And look how bad the consequences are, and it's affecting the world. Even in Vietnam, we didn't affect the world.
What, do you think that he has it within him? Boy, I know you work in the University of Chicago Political Science Center, not the Psychology Center. But I'm going to ask you either a social psychological question here, because you guys got some pretty good professors there on that too. Do you think that Donald Trump has it within him, has the wherewithal, has the capability to step away from this thing and admit uncle or whatever the hell the refrain is?
Let me just point out that he fundamentally reorganized himself to win re-election. That was something nobody thought he could do.
True.
Okay.
And well
he
done.
He did it.
Yeah.
And Susie, and so let's just understand. Now, that took years to reorient Donald Trump from the way he was behaving in campaigns before here. And then, and what I think here is, and this isn't about psychology or therapy for Trump, this is the reality that I think between now and the midterms, he's probably stuck in a certain mindset, Rick, because he doesn't have the time. The alternative of like mindsets here would take several years, much like his re-election campaign. He didn't win re-election in a day. Hmm. He didn't have just one post and suddenly, oh, that was the magic that turned everything over. He got Susie Wiles. They had an 18-month campaign. He stuck to it. He really, and notice that he went for the Hispanics when nobody thought he was going to go. All the things that happened here, Rick. Again, I frustrate my Democratic friends when I explain that Trump has real strengths. The issue here is in the short term between now and the midterms, that's where Trump is especially looking for the quick win. That is why he keeps going back to the same mindset, punish him more, punish him more. And I expect we're going to see more of that, not so much as a constant thing, but probably abruptly on, off, on again, punishment, similar to what you've been seeing in the last
But the more he does that, the more he causes pain for the people that he wants eventually to vote for him. Here's cut two. A reporter is asking the president this question that I just raised. This is Trump cut two. Gene, go ahead.
The most important thing by far is Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon.
What about the pressure on Americans and prices right now?
Every American understands
how they're feeling about
every American. Are you listening to me? Every American understands. They understand that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. If Iran has a nuclear weapon, the whole world would be in trouble. This war is over. Oil is going to drop. The stock market's going to go through the roof. And truly, I think we're in the golden age right now. You're going to see a golden age like we've never seen before.
This guy can sell land in the Everglades. I saw the CPI report. It came out yesterday. It's horrific. Horrific. 3.8%. Yeah. They're trying to hold inflation in the United States at 2%. It's almost at 4%. It's almost doubled. Everything. Shelter, clothing, food, gasoline. Everything was up yesterday in that CPI report. That is not a good picture. And what he's saying is I don't think it's true. He's saying American people understand what's going on and they're fine. No, they're not.
But here's one of the things, I have a different lens on this, because for a book I have coming out on American political violence, I went to Trump rallies when he was running. Really? I went to his return to Butler. So again, a lot of people think us professors, we just stay behind the computer. I'm telling you, it's really a lot of the, I'm sorry to say, the media is the ones who are now stuck behind. I didn't see any media at the, not real media, at the Trump rallies. And I was went to four of them, Rick, because I wanted to understand for myself.
Yeah.
And I was there standing up, no sitting, for 12 hours, barely any water. I watched dozens of people drop over the, and they were proud. They were wearing it like Purple Hearts. These are, they're, the amount of support here for President Trump is really, I think it's hard to capture unless you stood there for 12 hours over and over again in different rallies in different parts of the country. And what I think is, it will come down some. I understand that. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, we're missing this. And what would hurt President Trump the most with his own people would be to own the L. If he really says, I'm a loser, just think about this for a moment. What if he really says that, is he really going to gain politically? Really, really? No, I think this is what the Democrats want to keep beating him up this way, and a lot of independents will. But I think Trump knows. When he says he knows MAGA, I actually think we got to listen to a guy who spent more time with MAGA than anybody else here. And I only spent 4 weekends with MAGA, okay? But I'm telling you, that was different than going to, I'm sorry to say, the Kamala Harris campaign. People did not line up for 12 and 15 hours starting at 7 a.m.
No, she was horrible. Yeah.
I mean, it did not happen, Rick.
Yeah.
And I know, I went to 4 Harris rallies, including in my hometown, Erie, Pennsylvania, where I really know the town, okay? And she starts talking at 5 or 6 o'clock. You can get there at 3:30 or 4 and plenty of seats. So this was not with Donald Trump. With Donald Trump, you had to get there. If you were there after 10 a.m., you were having to get binoculars to see. I mean, and he wasn't going to talk until he would say 5, Rick, and then he would show up late always. I mean, really, he's just the master of all this.
Well, you know where Donald Trump, I think, is going to be seen, not as a loser, but as someone who is diminished, big countries like China, even Russia.
And
countries who are looking at this, South Korea, Japan, who say, wait a minute, you couldn't protect those guys? How the hell are you going to protect us? Here's Trump arriving. Here's Trump arriving in China today. Let's look at the video of this, and you'll see him. Great fanfare. You know, the Chinese are very respectful people. They've got the bands. They want to show him like they really appreciate the fact that he's come there. They're doing everything right. But behind the scenes, these guys are looking at this guy as, you know what? We got him right where we want him. He is weakened right now, and we ain't going to give him anything. That's what I'm thinking, but you're smarter than I am.
You got it exactly, Rick. I mean, this is a little bit like the snake that's looking you in the eye to charm you, and then it strikes. So this is, and it's not unique to like Chinese culture or something. Hmm. This is the way great power politics is played. And by the way, that's how Donald Trump explained it on the campaign trail. He said, look, I'm going to have to go up against the toughest, most ruthless, most clever, most cunning people in the world here. And well, now he is. The difference is he's coming in with this strategic defeat now that has happened to him. It's not the war. It's not exactly the war is over. That's not it at all. But at the moment, we've been in this now almost 3 months. Right. Think about this. And we've got nothing really to show for it on our side. And Iran has a lot on their side. And everybody's seeing that. It's now the public here. As I just said, MAGA is going to be really quite strongly with Trump unless he makes a real mistake. But the rest of the world, you see this with the Saudis here. You showed the clip here of how early on in March, this was in March,
yeah,
they did the bombing that you were showing.
Yeah.
Well, just recently in the last 8 days here, the Saudis have said you can't use our airspace. And then there had to be a big conversation between Trump and MBS over that. I mean, this was not a small thing. Because if you look at how big Saudi Arabia is, you can't use that airspace. That's a big extra problem for you as any kind of hitting Iran. So what you're seeing is then Merz here added insult to injury with his statements. You're seeing the Iranian negotiators themselves Donald Trump is trying to send Kushner and Witkoff to Pakistan to meet with them and crash the party, essentially. And the Iran negotiator said, oh, yeah, go ahead, land in Islamabad. We're gone. We're going to Russia. Think how insulting that is.
I talked to some sources in the Persian Gulf states today. By the way, the Iranians like it when you say Persian Gulf states as opposed to Gulf states. They say when you say the Gulf country or the Gulf states, you must be talking about like Naples or Tampa or something. Interestingly enough, but I talked to some of my sources today in UAE, for example, and they were telling me, some of the people in the business community there, that they're expecting a tilt toward more of a open relationship with the Chinese and the Russians. They're not going to turn their backs on America at all. They want to continue that relationship, but it's not going to be as one-sided in the future as it is today. That's what they told me. Does that make sense?
And that makes perfect, absolutely perfect sense. So sort of 2 points on this. First thing that's happening is with the America's defeat here, and with the fact we've had to pull back our, we had all the bases smashed more than, now we're just learning the full details, and we have to keep our carriers so far away. The Gulf states here, and I don't know if I should call them the Persian Gulf states,
but the Gulf states
are seeing that, and they're seeing America's getting scared to help us here. Well, that means they've got to do more on their own bottom. In other words, there's a bit of a, what you're seeing is a fragmentation, an atomization, where each country now realizes America is not quite that golden safety net that they thought. So they have to look for some other safety net, some other insurance. Now, there's nothing that's perfect in this world for them. So that's why you're seeing, well, let's kind of talk about with China, with Russia. It's not like there's a perfect backup here. No. This is the world of fragmentation. This is what it looks like. And they're all kind of inching here or there. They're not quite sure where to make their bets here. And this is the world going to go on for months, Rick. Mm. This is not like there's people, I know, they emotionally want an equilibrium. They want this everything to settle down instead of feeling like you're in sand and you're constantly shifting and so forth. Unfortunately, this is the world that is going to be with us for a while. We're not going to have this stable. It's going to be shifting around. You're going to see we're going to probably move unstably from some escalation to non-escalation. The Gulf states are going to be shifting around. And this is what we unleashed. What we did is we took a situation that was fairly stable. We've destabilized it. And there's not a stable equilibrium on the other end.
Right. Yeah, we threw gasoline at this. And as a result, we have created what many people in the world who I talk to have long wanted. They've wanted a more multipolar world. It looks to me like we will come out of this with a more multipolar world. And historians will say it was the Donald Trump presidency that made America less powerful, I guess?
This war, Rick, is like the 1991 Gulf War after the end of the Cold War. What happened in, we ended the Cold War in about 1990, and 1991 was the Gulf War that then set the pattern, set the rules, so to speak, the new technology. Remember, that war too had the surprising technology for the world of the hyper-accuracy of U.S. precision weapons. Mm. This war is quite similar. It's a hinge war. It's not just another war. This is a hinge war. It's the first war in, I call it the post-liberal order. So we used to have this thing we called the liberal order, 1975, NATO, Bretton Woods, all of that. That started World War II, 75 years of this order from World War II, 1945. And I would say it died in 2025. It was dying on life support. And this is the first war in the new post liberal order age.
You have such a full-throated understanding contextually of who we are as a country, the greatness of America institutionally, historically, while at the same time being able to explain what we've done and the consequences of it. I fear this, And I hate to say it, but there are some people surrounding Donald Trump who don't come anywhere near that. And most notably, it's this fellow named Hegseth, who I worked with, by the way. As you know, I worked at Fox and I worked at CNN and I worked at NBC. Not a bad guy, but listen to him here explaining to reporters what's going on in Iran. Look how little context there is here.
We are winning, have won every component of what we fought in this conflict. Iran knows that based on the incredible degradation of their capabilities, and which is why we saw them wanting to come to the table. How this gets resolved will be on our terms, on President Trump's terms, and we have all the munitions and capabilities necessary to enable that.
Is it a lack of understanding, or is he showing up for the boss?
So I have taught Hegseth for decades. So keep in mind, he's a Princeton grad. So that means he was an undergrad. I have this at the University of Chicago. I taught for the U.S. Air Force. I taught mid-level officers. Yeah. He was a mid-level officer. I have great, I don't know him personally. I've never met him, but I've literally been teaching hundreds of people like Pete Hegseth in the world who are going in the government and going in the military. The problem here is he's not general material and he's not above general material because he hasn't spent the time to really educate himself in strategy to any extent whatsoever. Now, given his jobs, he wouldn't have had to. It's not like he probably knows something about busting down doors, because what at the mid levels in the military, you are basically tactics. And so what you see is he goes to tactics all the time. But in terms of whether the use of force can change politics and how it impacts politics, that's the higher level. That's what I'm doing, Rick. That's what the 3- and 4-star generals need to start to do. That's what happens in the West Wings. Now, it's up to President Trump to surround himself with people who have some depth in that. And I'm not saying it's easy. I've not ever run for president, much less won, and much less been reelected the way he... So this is not for me to be really throwing stones here. But the bottom line is... That's what you're seeing here, Rick. I've seen hundreds of Pete Hegseths here, and they start my class. 10 weeks later, they come out a different person. They understand more of strategy. Hegseths just never had that. And now he's in a situation he can't admit that he doesn't know. Because if he's been elevated. It's the Peter principle. He's been elevated to the level of failure, and it's because he really wasn't in a good position to succeed. And he's never going to succeed here because he just doesn't have the depth, and you can't learn all this on the fly. You just can't.
That's a great point. And here's what I've learned at my ripe, ripe old age. After being, you know, like the rest of us, you know, proud American journalist. And now I've gone around the world. And, you know, in the last year, I've talked to Medinsky, the top negotiator for Mr. Putin. I talked to Mr. Lavrov. I talked to the Chinese negotiators and business people. I talked to the Indians. Obviously, I spent a week that you saw my coverage probably in Iran. And I talked to all these people. And I do find, Professor, they're more serious than we are. They're real serious. The people, a guy like Medinsky and Lavrov and these guys, their whole life has been studying the nuances of negotiation and diplomacy and what you do. And if we do this, then they do that. And they come in with books and pamphlets prepared. It almost seems like we've become kind of theatrical chest thumpers in America.
Well, what's happening, so you have seen that up close and personal. You can compare Lavrov, for instance, in his depth to Pete Hegseth, and you can see right away. So Pete Hegseth lives in a clickbait world. He lives in a world that's basically come up here with our cell phones, where so much can happen politically and financially. You can get really rich, you can become really famous, you can become really important politically here with just the thinness of knowledge possible. And in fact, having too much knowledge may slow you down because they're moving so fast. That means you're constantly making short-term decisions, Rick. And as long as you're going after very minor targets here, you're going after, you're not really going to do much with Greenland. But even if we did, they've only got 60,000 people. I'm sorry to pick on Greenland. Venezuela, you're talking about just taking one leader, and suddenly you just won World War II. No, this. So as long as you're going after these really small change here, that's going to be okay. You can live in that clickbait environment, but that's not where a Lavrov is. That's not where a Xi is. That's not where Iran is.
Right.
These folks have been forced by the reality of their situation to have not just one person, but a seas of people that have been thinking about things, not just in a clickbait world or short term, but over time. And look at the Iran's preparations here for this round. You see, it's not like they ended last June and they said, oh, man, we're going to never worry about this again. What you can see is they thought hard about what is the sequence of the missiles they should use when the U.S. and Israel does this again. How do we sucker Israel and the United States to use up and expand their boutique weapons while we keep our best stuff behind, you know, in ready? This is not happening randomly. And it's also, I want to say, it's not that they've got 150 IQ or something. What's happening is it's a longer term perspective, whereas we're basically in a clickbait world. And this is why I say what President Trump really needs is he needs a longer term strategy here. And what he's been building here is if you read the national security strategy of the Trump administration, it looks like it's just AI generated. Some of the maps look like they're AI generated. It doesn't look at all like you would see with Brent Scowcroft or they used to be called the Vulcans. If you're well, look up the Vulcans here. We do have a world in which we have people that have dedicated their lives, 30 years studying air power, I don't know, you know, to issues here. But if we just keep deciding that clickbait beats expertise and depth, and not understanding that the politics here is the issue. It's not how to put bombs on targets, Rick. The issue is when you start using force, you're changing politics. So this is what President Trump said. He doesn't understand why Iran is not buckling. Well, that's because he's thinking about it as a real estate deal.
Yes.
He's thinking, he doesn't even understand the difference between seizing a Maduro and trying to take on this gigantic animal called Iran.
And besides, I mean, look at just the needs. You and I know this, and most people who are educated know this. Iran has existential necessities. To them, this is about a 6,000-year-old civilization that fought against the Greeks and fought against the Romans. And this is not new to them. And for us, it's about getting this thing over so our gas prices will go down. I mean, compare those two things.
That's right. If President Trump had wanted, remember when he went into Venezuela, he wanted Venezuela to triple the amount of oil production it was going to do. And then what happened is after a couple of weeks, he abandoned that objective, essentially. Yeah. Did it quietly. He didn't say he was doing it, but he did. And notice that it made everything go well. Suddenly it was fine with Rodriguez. Suddenly things were going well. It's because the ambition of what he wanted out of Venezuela was tiny. It's pennies on the dollar compared to what he's asking Iran. He's asking... So we should also, one way to put it is, in Iran, everybody's heard there's 92 million people. 1 in 8 of those adults gets money from the government of Iran. 1 in 8. That means if there's a regime change, those 1 in 8 will fight hard, because if they lose, they're the ones, all 1 in 8, who are going to get strung up on the lamppost. You see, there's a lot of reason why it's existential for for Iran, because they've been so brutal to their people, Rick. You actually get a regime change, this is going to look like Ceausescu. This is going to look like what happened to Gaddafi. I mean, there's going to be blood in the streets. And what that means is that 1 in 8, and think of how many millions that is, they're not just going to say, oh, sure, President Trump, we'll do what you say. Their lives are literally on the line, and that's what's holding back this real estate paradigm.
Let's finish up with this, the interactivity of theaters. And we've got two at present in this world, both of which you're very familiar with. Obviously, the situation right now that everybody's paying attention to is Iran, but there's also the Ukraine front. And it's interesting. Actually, when I was in a meeting with Mr. Putin in Sochi not long ago, I found him to be less nerdy than a lot of the other guys who negotiate for him. But he said something recently the other day, which I thought, I didn't know if it was off the cuff or not. I doubt it, because with Russians, very few things are off the cuff. He said, the war will be over soon, in so many words. And it seems to me that the Iran situation has weakened Ukraine. And I think the Russian generals see that and know that. And they haven't made a big move yet because of winter and sloppy ground or whatever the hell it's called. But it seems to me that they will make a big move soon. And when Putin says it'll be over soon, who knows what he means? But he means something, right?
Yes. There's a window here. It's called a window in strategic language that has been created, Rick, by the Iran war. The window is that the Europeans, who were all talking about filling in the vacuum, America was going to be leaving and so forth, that window is a window has been created because Europeans now have massive economic problems here, and those governments have to try to stay in power, much less deal with Ukraine. So what you are seeing is they too are fragmenting more than they were. Merz, when he came out, it wasn't just humiliating the United States. The Germans put out a strategy paper where they want leadership of Europe. Well, Macron wanted leadership of Europe too, and you've also got the British. So what you're seeing is this, if you're looking at it from Lavrov or Putin's perspective, you're seeing a window here where you've got a lot of money coming in. The Europeans are fragmenting more than they were, and they have economic problems like they didn't have. And if you don't take advantage of this, say, by the end of the summer, which takes a little while, they're going to think about what they're going to do. But if you don't take advantage of it now, you can't guarantee, if you're Putin, that you're going to have that same set of advantages 12 months from now or 18 months from now. That's why Lavrov on April 24th, just for your listeners to go to, he gave a big speech that your listeners should go to, where he said that they are up against war against the West. So don't be surprised, by the way, if what this means for us here, and I'm sorry to make more scary scenarios, Russia controls 11% of the world's oil. You now see Iran with 20%. What are those two talking about in Moscow here? Maybe ways to hurt the West harder than they've already been hurt. Yeah. And that would make sense for Russia, again, to take that window, try to drive through a window and really weaken your enemy over the next 6 or 8 months while you're doing that. These are my nightmare. These are the real dangers in great power politics that I think, President Trump, he's looking at this day by day, hour by hour. But the rest of the world's not. They're figuring out what can they do over 6 or 8 months to really hurt us and make gains. And I'm afraid to say the Russians are right there doing that.
Yeah, they're in a strong position. The Indians are trying to figure it out. And the Chinese, I think, when all this is said and done, and we'll know, maybe you and I will have another conversation about this in the future, but I think the Chinese are going to be telling Mr. Trump some things he's not going to want to hear. I think they're going to be saying, you know what? Ixay, nixay, enough with your sanctions, enough with your tariffs. We're just not going to pay attention to these things anymore. We're moving ahead.
Taiwan is going to be a big issue here coming out of this, whether it's public or not.
Yes.
For sure. What she here is, I don't think, Rick, you're going to see that it would actually help us if she would attack Taiwan, because then Trump would get bailed out. Everybody get mad at the Chinese. I don't think she's going to do that. What she is going to want, though, is more leverage. And Trump's brought all the tech pros with him. That means you might see quid pro quo. There'll be some business deals here that Trump may like if Trump gives in more on Taiwan. Yeah. That's the linkage.
China will not bail on Iran. I think they've made a commitment to Iran. They need won't. Iran's energy.
And they also want to grow in the Middle East. You yourself were just talking. Saudi Arabia is building more ties to China.
Yes.
Why would China want to rock a boat that's moving in its direction. So people, I think we misunderstand here. China has been weaning itself off of oil. Only 20% now of energy needs in China come from oil. So much is now solar, and only 38% of that from the Persian Gulf. And when I was in China for 2 weeks last June, visiting, touring the advanced industries, talking with the business leaders, they definitely understand this. If anything, they're glad America is going to get in another quagmire here. They may lose a percent of GNP in the short term, but they're explaining to me this is going to make it sort of like a lot of people will remember It's a Wonderful Life when there's a run on the bank and Jimmy Stewart says, Potter's not helping you. He's picking up bargains.
Not going to do that. They're hard to do that. Right. What? I was doing my Jimmy Stewart imitation. Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Well, yeah, but you can see, Rick, you could do that. You could probably play this here and have the China thing. She is Potter. He's picking up bargains while everybody else is panicking.
Yeah.
He's not helping anybody.
They know exactly what they're doing because they always come in with at least a 20-year plan. And we come in trying to figure out what's going to be on CNN tomorrow.
What's the next week?
Yeah, exactly. You have been, oh, my God, what a wonderful conversation. You know, you are such a smart guy. You think through all of these things. I enjoy following everything that you put out, and I've just been so honored to have you on my show today. Thank you, Professor.
Well, Rick, it's a real pleasure because also the fact that you've had so many interviews with so many great leaders, your depth here is, and I'm not just saying this, but honestly, a lot of people live in the super clickbait world, but the fact is you're taking the time to get depth with the people that matter, and that just allows for more depth. And I hope your listeners really do appreciate the ability that we, if they listen, I've done what, maybe 120 of these podcasts here over the last 10 weeks here. Just if you compare them here, this is right at the cream of the crop because you know so much and you bring so much. And that's our basic point to the world. And that's what's happening on my Substack. The people want this depth.
Yes.
You see what I mean? And,
yes.
And this is really, I think there's a hunger for it. And we've just got to find ways. I think we're still in the earlier middle ground time of taking advantage of it. There's not that many professors who do what I've been doing to just jump at this stage in their career to do the Substack. And then I'm interacting and I'm doing these live. Yeah, I'm doing things that I just wouldn't a year ago even have known about. You see, and people are constantly giving me new ideas, and I'm saying, sure, let's give that a shot.
Before I let you go, then, if people want to give you new ideas or want to find you, where would they go?
The Escalation Trap Substack is a big one here. That's the big one. I have actually a couple Substacks, but please go to the Escalation Trap Substack. The Professor Pape one is. Even more big picture. So if you really want a lot of Pape here, you'll get. But the tracking of the war is what most people want. That's the Escalation Trap Substack. X's have been exploding as well. That's at Professor Pape. And there's going to be more things here. We're now a week from Friday, May 22nd, trying to do a live in-person event for some of the Substack that we're going to try to broadcast, if we can, over 100,000 people on Substack. And I'm partnering with some people. This is what I meant by ideas. People are saying, well, wait a minute. Why can't we even, why are we having to be stovepiped in a world that we can connect? And that's what I'm seeing, Rick. And so this is something as we go forward here, I'm seeing, why are we at just 63,000 on Substack over, you know, a period of 10 weeks here? And it's because I'm not seeing a limit yet to the hunger that people have.
No,
and
no.
It's not just about me. It's as I'm trying to say, your audience is undoubtedly seeing the same thing. So why aren't we doing more connectivity here? I think that this is the people, this is what it means to. The legacy media is just too limited.
Yeah.
It's just too limited.
And dishonest.
And, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. And not pushed.
Yeah.
Not pushed. You would push me. We push each other here because we have a long time. So you can, your producers can come up, oh, Professor Pape said X. No. Let's call him out on that. This is the world I live in at the University of Chicago. When I say something, my colleagues at the I'm telling you, professors here, they're tough on each other more than you might realize.
That's good. That's good.
They just will come right at you, man. And the students too, man. They love to play I got the professor.
Well, it's the University of Chicago. A lot of smart people there. You're kind of an Ivy League school in many ways. Well, listen, count on me. Count on us. Let's continue this relationship, and I'd love to get you back, and we'll do another conversation sometime soon. Thank you, Professor. Okay, God bless. Take care.
You have a great day, and we'll see you again. We'll definitely
do. So we'll do. Bye-bye. Well, wow. What a smart man. You know, I've been watching his videos. He's been on a lot of the top videos and top television shows all over the world, and he's been doing a lot of podcasts lately, and we were having a meeting in our team, and I said, this guy has unique and original ideas. And unlike a lot of professors, how do I say this? He's not boring, you know what I mean? He's not boring, he's real. And there's a passion to him in the ideas that he expresses. And this is why I wanted to bring him to you. This is why I'm so excited to be able to share him with you. And I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Let me know what you think. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. And thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you again next time. Arrivederci. Bye-bye.